The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. On today's pod, we'll ask if Manchester United having two designated penalty takers is the biggest crime in the history of the game. We'll take a detailed look and speak to fans of Bury and Bolton as the two sides' futures become increasingly certain. There's a Serie A preview and a look ahead to the big games in the Premier League this weekend. And we'll discuss Daniel Sturridge in Turkey, a red card for Rooney and arsenic in Miami. All that plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly Extra. On the panel today, Barry Glendenning, hello.
Hello, Max.
It's nice to see you.
And you.
Philippe Auclair, hello.
Hello to you, Max.
It's nice to see you too.
It's very nice to see you.
Nicky Bandini, hello.
Hi.
It is nice to see you.
Good.
There will be people who aren't on social media or unbelievably don't read The Guardian who may not have seen your relatively momentous news, I'd say, from the last time we saw you.
Yes, people may not even know who you're talking to when you say Nicky Bandini. Listeners to this podcast will have known me as Paolo Bandini. I came out this summer as transgender. I have written a piece about that for The Guardian for anyone who cares to know more about it. Other than that, nothing much to say.
Otherwise, same old Serie A, Arsenal
nice
supporting
to see you
nonsense.
Too, Max. I forgot
exactly.
to say that before.
Oh, thanks very much. Look, I would say it's important, but it's clearly not as important as Manchester United having two designated penalty takers, which, according to Gary Neville, Barry, was the biggest outrage of the century. Paul Pogba took that penalty on Monday night. He missed it. Marcus Rashford had scored one against Chelsea.
Yeah.
How outrageous? How outraged are you?
I wasn't outraged at all. I was a bit surprised, but because Paul Pogba isn't a particularly good penalty taker, he's missed four, I think, in the last year, whereas Marcus Rashford had scored one the previous week. Gary Neville did go into that sort of squawky parrot mode he goes into when he's particularly exercised over something, and I think himself and Jamie Carragher got 40 minutes out of it in the post-match analysis, which is quite something. I'm not a fan of players sorting out between themselves who should take a penalty. I think you should have one designated penalty taker. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer said they have two and they decide between themselves. And then Marcus Rashford said a curious thing when he was interviewed. He said, well, it's simple. If you want to take it, you take it. And that's not simple, because if they both want to take it, only one of them can take it. And that's evidently what happened there. Paul Pogba took it. He missed. It's not the end of the world. It's a talking point. I can see why it was a talking point, but
but two players can take a penalty. They could have done the Bobby Pires, Thierry Henry, or the Johan Cruyff thing, you know, so that everybody's happy.
So what, instead of having a row, they get together and they say, we'll do this one together.
Uh-huh.
That's fine. I suppose, Nicky, it's kind of, it does feel like a manager should say, right, here's who's on set pieces. You're doing that, you're doing that, you're doing that, crack on.
Well, I've seen some commentary on this which suggests that actually one of Solskjaer's big things this summer was to empower his players to be responsible and make decisions themselves, and little stuff like having them playing games of head tennis in training and them refereeing themselves, so that they had to get used to making decisions that were difficult and people might disagree with, where there weren't clear lines. And I think he sort of has taken this view that players taking responsibility for stuff and perhaps collective responsibility in these situations is a positive thing. I get that people can disagree with it. I think we can also massively overthink this. I know there's this thing that, oh, Pogba's missed three penalties, whereas Rashford has taken two and he hasn't missed them. So these are, you know, such small sample sizes, they're ridiculous. It was, I thought, still a pretty decent penalty. I have this sort of personal bugbear about players who are fouled taking their own penalties. I have this low-level conviction that they have a lower conversion rate, but that's founded in nothing, so I don't know if someone's done the numbers on that. But beyond
that, you just think they're just a bit hurt, or might be a bit sad, or
I don't know. I think it's trying too hard, like feeling like, yes, I've got my penalty now. I don't know, but I think there's almost certainly no numbers behind that, and just superstition from watching too much football.
I reckon exactly that much has been done about almost nothing. And it's also, they didn't quite have a fight, as we have seen in the past. It was just a gentle conversation. But like Barry, I'm a little bit surprised that it hadn't been set out, you know, from the outset that so-and-so would take the penalties and that would be that.
James says, please, can you talk about Patricio's penalty save and not just meaningless discussion about who should have taken the penalty? It was a good save, Baz.
Yeah, it was. He dived to his right, block the ball. I'm not sure what more you could say about it, really.
We've done what James wanted.
I don't know if he came off his line or not, but that's allowed, isn't it, in the Premier League? That's one of the laws that the Premier League have decided to ignore.
Well, they have, although IFAB have just sent quite a snotty letter saying you specifically on that one that you have to follow the laws of the game, which I sort of guess is quite sensible, but it's not a law that I want them to follow.
And Pierluigi Collina, I think, had been absolutely clear about it and is reportedly absolutely furious about it. So
what, he's furious that the Premier League aren't using VAR?
Absolutely. And apparently there had been discussions as early as March about this. And, you know, when the leagues were told about what, you know, the new laws. To be honest, are they laws or regulations? Are they part of the laws or not? I'm always saying laws. Okay. And that everybody was aware of it, and that basically the Premier League decided to do things their way, the Premier League way, with ignoring the others.
And what has Donald Tusk said about the handball law?
Now, I'd like to say something about this.
You may say whatever.
Say one thing about it.
Yeah, we need to explain we need to explain the background, which is...
Go on.
Ian Holloway, who I have worked with and is a delightful man, was on The Debate, which is a show on Sky, where he, I believe, was trying to say... I've seen him since, and he was trying to say, I want us to be able to decide what laws we have... And he was conflating that with Brexit. It came across very much, if you watched it and didn't have the opportunity to see him the next day, which is most people, that he kind of thought if we left the EU, we could make our own laws of football.
So, first of all, he's a master of non sequiturs. and second, obviously, he's completely wrong, because the laws are not changed just by FIFA, but by IFAB. And interestingly enough, any change in the laws has got to be agreed by actually 6 out of the 8 representatives who sit on IFAB, which means that FIFA has got 4 votes. So for the law to come through, it has to have the support of 2 of the home nations, which it did. So obviously he has perhaps not very well informed.
Ian says, following the lead of Ian Holloway, what would English football... free from the shackles of the EU laws, look like no Cruyff turns, Beckenbauer sweepers banned, Yusuf Catenaccio liable for a prison sentence. I will talk to Ollie because I like you tweeted, Baz, he's a genuinely lovely man. I think he's open to... There are other people I've worked with who wouldn't necessarily be open to being told that they were factually incorrect, but he is humble enough to know that he would be. And back to the game, Wolves... Nicky were sort of non-existent in the first half, weren't they?
Yeah, United started so well, and I really like this attack with Anthony Martial leading it. I think he's clearly empowered this season in the way that he hasn't been in his sort of recent past at United. I think it's weird. You spin back the clock to when Ibrahimovic arrived, and there was this moment actually where Martial thought he was going to be the number 9. He thought that was going to be his job, and Ibrahimovic took it away from him, and then Lukaku gets it. And I think that dynamic with him and Rashford up front for United is really exciting.
Who is the one down the middle?
I think it's Martial. I mean, we're 2 games into the season. I get it. There's still some interchange there. I think definitely you see them both drifting out to the left and coming in and supporting each other like that. But Martial's certainly getting in behind, which suits him. His pace, he's so fast. And yes, I mean, Wolves are, as we've seen last season, when they... I can't remember how many points it was they took against the top 6, but a lot. and beating United twice in the space of just over a fortnight between the league and cup. They're a very good team at home. They made good adjustments at half-time and they came back into it. But I thought United didn't give them a chance to play in the first half, and that was what was so impressive about it.
Producer Jonathan has pointed out, I haven't said the score yet, if you didn't know, it was 1-1. and the second half, you're right, he did make changes, and Adama Traore came on, widely credited with changing the game. He is fun, isn't he, Traore?
I
wouldn't like to run into him.
I wouldn't have to like to have to run after him.
Yes.
His pace is searing. I'm not sure about his end product. His crossing is rather hit and miss more often than hit. If he's trying to pick someone out in the box, but yeah, I'm not sure. Did he come on? Was Matt Doherty injured, or was it a tactical?
I think there's a feeling that Doherty isn't fully fit at the moment. That's what my Wolves friend Martin tells me, anyway.
Okay, but yeah, Traore is a great player to have on the bench, and with a better end product, he would be an asset to any Premier League team.
They took 16 points off the top six.
That's it.
Last season, Nicky. 4 wins, 4 draws.
But they also started very slowly last season, which people have forgotten because of what happened later on. But if I'm not mistaken, it was something like 1 draw and 2 defeats or something like that. So they're a bit like a diesel. They take time.
Okay.
And nothing to be particular.
So they have to pay more to get into the middle of London now?
Yeah, and maybe, you know what? I mean, but thanks to Britain exiting the EU, there won't be this problem with diesel engines being, you know, outlawed or something.
Well,
like
they won't pollute anymore. That's what happened. It was a wonderful goal from Ruben Neves, Nicky, wasn't it?
Yes.
Just
yeah.
Stand back and admire it.
Yeah. Oh, so well taken. And I don't know. It feels like that's sort of his trademark almost at this point, that finish. Shame that we had to do the... Are we just not going to talk about the 2 minutes of VAR afterwards?
We can.
But my thought on it is less about the VAR, which is, you know, I support and getting the right decisions, but more about whether or not we want a time limit on it, because it just felt really long, this one. I think that's the thing that people are getting frustrated with. And some of that is just teething problems. People are going to get quicker at these decisions. I know you've been to VAR HQ.
I was brainwashed yesterday, in fact.
I'm sure you have a strong opinion on it. But, I mean... I think I'm raising it as much as anything because Nuno did after the game, saying this is a frustration in terms of the atmosphere at the stadium, but it was a beautiful goal.
It's also a frustration in terms of playing time, because it's also happened in the Arsenal game, where there was a VAR incident in added time, and no time was added to the added time. It's as if VAR was part, the whole process was part of the actual game, which is wrong.
I think what I've taken from the brainwashing exercise is that actually it was sort of disappointingly well organised, and Mike Riley and Neil Swarbrick were nice people, and there was nobody sort of like flashed a wand in front of my eyes and said,
Can you tell us exactly what it was that was well organised?
So
is it kind of symposium?
So there were lots of reporters there. Mark Schwarzer was there, a few people from Sky, et cetera, and they just took us through exactly how long they've been doing it, what they are using VAR for. There are two separate things. There's factual things. Has the ball crossed the line? Is he offside? Was that foul inside or outside the box? There are the subjective things. So Lamella's foul on Rodri, or they showed us the company lunge on Salah last season. And they said on both those incidents, the referee has seen the incident. They have made a call to say, look, I've seen Rodri and Lamella there. I've decided that's not enough for a penalty. I'm carrying on. It's a bit like umpires call in cricket.
Okay.
So then the VAR ref will look at that and go, okay, I've seen that. Maybe that ref would have given a foul, maybe not, but it's subjective. So they've said it's not such a big deal. This is this clear and obvious phrase that is really annoying. So we're just going to play on, because what they want to do is not stop football all the time, right? With big, big decisions, what was interesting, they showed us a clip of Crystal Palace v Grimsby, and a Grimsby player went over the top on Andros Townsend in like the second minute of the game. And the referee was Martin Atkinson, and you heard the commentary between him and John Moss, who was the fourth, the VAR. And Atkinson was saying he played advantage because Palace had the break, and he said, I'm going to book him. You heard him saying that to VAR. John Moss in the VAR was saying, I'm going to check that. Checked it, was over the top, said, that's a red card for me. Atkinson, and what the Premier League really want to do is not go to that telly on the halfway line all the time, because that takes so much time. This is the first time Philippe has taken notes when I've been talking, Barry. It's very exciting. So then John Moss just said to Martin Atkinson, that's a red card. Because they trust each other, he gave him a red card. So look, VAR have said, that's a red, I'm going to send you off. I think the big thing that we've talked about a lot is about the fan experience, and about how it would be great if that conversation could be heard on telly and in the grounds. And from what they said to me yesterday was, at the moment, because it's so early, they are worried that referees might be more conscious about speaking to millions of people watching than they would be about making the right decision. But within two, I don't know how many years, but it will ultimately get like cricket, in that we hear exactly what they're saying. I'm convinced about that. And as somebody who isn't really bothered if we have VAR or not, but feels you probably have to have it because so many people in the stadiums will look at their smartphone and go, that decision was wrong. Yeah. That's, I think, why it needs to be there. So maybe I have been brainwashed.
And I suppose, just to come back to it, because I feel like I maybe skimmed it too quickly, the Neves goal, in case anyone hasn't seen it, I mean, it's edge of the D, sort of instep, right off the bar. I feel like we've seen that finish from him before, but it's still, I mean, he's, and if, I don't know, underside of the bar is just the best goal, isn't it?
Every time. And the build-up as well, I think. It was from a corner, just a brilliantly worked corner, and what a finish. And he seemed to get the ball sort of stuck under his feet as well, but managed to dig it out and still place it in the top corner.
Producer Jonathan's very upset with Aaron Wan-Bissaka, saying he ducked underneath it. Is that worse than turning your back? Which, turning your back is worse than having two designated penalty takers.
So you're supposed to take it in the mush.
He turned his back and he ducked. Should they sell him immediately back to Palace?
Is it a bigger scandal than Manchester United having two people quibbling about who's taking the penalty?
I don't know. But yeah, it's a fair, I mean, face up to it. I certainly would have got out the way. there's been a fair bit of chat about Wolves breaking into the top six, Manchester United falling out of it. What, if anything, does this tell us, Baz, or is that a ludicrous question 2 games in?
I think it's a ludicrous question 2 games in. I've already written a column and I think said in the pod, I don't think Wolves will make the top six. They'd have to buck a pretty regular trend in recent years of teams who get into the Europa League. They tend to drop between 12 and 18 points the season afterwards. Whether it's to do with Europa League exertions or not, I don't know. Some of those teams haven't actually qualified for the group stages, but it may have disrupted their pre-season preparations. So as much as I admire Wolves, I suspect they will do worse in the league this season than last.
And they play Torino tonight.
Yeah, I was going to say, when Baz has already named it, saying that it might not make a difference whether or not they get through, but they haven't got an easy path to the group stage. I mean, Torino played really well last season. They've managed to have a very quiet summer, which I think is what they needed. They're not... I would say Wolves are a more compelling team to watch. Torino are Walter Mazzarri at his...
most boring
and least sort of thrilling best, but they've been very effective. So that'll be a really interesting tie.
Will be very interesting is the lineup as well that Nuno is going to choose for that. I don't know if there are any indications already, but he changed 9 players, didn't he, for the previous round? And this is a much, much stronger opponent that he has. And with looks a bit like almost like a good toss to lose, this one, the Torino game. Even if people apparently in the Midlands are very, very excited. It's a sellout.
I think, to be honest with you, like, that's one thing about this tie. It's got that sort of slightly...
Feels like the 70s to me.
And Torino play in a stadium in Turin that is old and by any objective standard dilapidated. But it's one of those grounds where even though it's got the running track, even when it's not full, I mean, the home end make a noise. Like, it's a loud stadium for being a stadium that you wouldn't look at and think this is going to have a great atmosphere. So I think, if nothing else, 2 legs of proper atmosphere, proper, I don't know.
Are you saying, Philippe, that Wolves should bin off the Europa League?
If they want to do better than they did last year in the league, yes. Because the thing
they'd be binning off the Europa League probably try and get in the Europa League.
I know, that's the question that is asked absolutely every time. Certainly in France it is every time, and when our clubs which go to the Europa League generally sink or don't take it seriously at all or whatever. And that's why I say it's a real dilemma. If you choose a very strong team to play against Torino in the 2 legs and you get to the group phase, then you start, you know, having to take this competition very seriously indeed, because and which is where the problem will start, because the squad has been reinforced, but not much, certainly not enough to play on both fronts.
I think, especially
for a manager who is not a great fan of turnover.
Sure, but yeah. I tend to think that if you're a Wolves fan, you've qualified through Europa League.
You won the glory
last season. It's you're going to Turin. Like, how amazing is that? And then who knows where you go and
I'd give them a squeak of win in that competition if they were in it. I mean, they probably won't, but it's quite possible they could.
And they're not going to go down, are they?
So, of course not.
You know, take 17th upwards
The question we're just asking is, can they get into the top six? So the point of getting into the top six is to play in this competition.
Of course.
I mean, go and enjoy it.
Yeah.
The only thing is, could they get in the top four? And I think if they didn't have the Europa League, they possibly could.
Yeah.
Possibly. That depends on how Chelsea do, how Manchester United do. They're both showing signs.
And how Arsenal do, right?
Yeah. So,
You've got
if I was a Wolves fan, I would certainly want them to be as competitive as possible in the Europa League.
All right, that'll do for part one. In part two, we will focus on Bolton Wanderers and Bury. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Baz, we're going back out on the road.
Hurrah.
The 10th of September, we're in Manchester.
Manchester.
I meet you, Lars Sivertsen and Jonathan Wilson. And then on the 20th of September, we're in Leeds.
Excellent.
Yeah. Me, you, Jonathan Wilson and Faye Carruthers, live show debut, opera glasses and all.
Fantastic.
So if you are in...
So basically the lead show is just going to be Jonathan Wilson telling stories about Marcelo Bielsa for an hour and a half and the rest of us sit there drinking.
Well, I'm happy to do 2 minutes on Tony Yeboah.
Okay.
Who do you want to do?
I could talk about Robbie Keane for a few minutes.
Okay, that's fine.
I've seen you do a... maybe spoiling this for the viewers, a Robbie Keane forward roller live show, Baz.
Yeah, and I fractured a rib.
Well, we'll definitely bring that back. So that's 10th of September in Manchester, 20th of September in Leeds. We'll tweet out all the details. Come along, please. Right, now we usually round up the midweek football results here. We're going to talk to some people directly affected by the problems faced by two clubs in League One who sit on minus points in very real danger of going out of business, Bolton and Bury. We'll start with Bury. Dave Gifford is from Forever Bury. Dave, thanks for coming on. How are you doing?
All right, hello. Struggling a bit under all the pressures we're under.
Yeah, absolutely. Just explain to the listeners who Forever Bury are.
We're the Supporters Trust. We're a body of fans. We formed in 2002 when the club was in a similar crisis, and to date we've put over £500,000 into the club, trying to make the place a family-friendly club.
And what is the current state of play as you understand it with Bury Football Club?
It's difficult. We've got an owner that won't talk to anybody, just rants, and you put valid bidders in front of him, he doesn't want to know unless they're going to line his pockets with vast amounts of money. He's paid a pound for it, and he just wants to make money on it, but 100% it will be £2, but he's looking for millions. We as a trust, we've been vetting various potential buyers. We've spent £36,000 now on legal fees and consultancy fees, trying to get a resolution. We've got some credible bidders there, and some are actually reluctant to talk to him because they know there's no point. But we've got them there. They want to buy the club. It's how we can remove the chairman.
If the worst happens, A, what effect will it have on the town? And B, have you made sort of provisions to set up a Phoenix club?
We've covered all aspects. We've got all the paperwork ready for administration if that was needed. We've had that some time. We've got a new company ready to launch. We've got a thing called Project Phoenix again. If we need to launch, the difficult thing would be acquiring this ground. That's the one thing we'd like to do as a fans group, is get hold of the ground and safeguard it for the future.
And for Bury itself, there are lots of people listening all over the world, right, who probably don't even know where Bury is. Like, how vital is this football club to the town?
Well, we're just 9 miles north of Manchester, and like within an hour you can get to 7 or 8 Premiership clubs and similar number of Championship clubs. It's an area thick with football clubs. Yes, it's competition, but as a town, the town of Bury has about 60,000 people. There's a metro area that's the local government that covers 6 townships. It's about 220,000, and the loss of the club would take about £3 million a year out of the local economy. There's one pub just been sold this week, one that Bury fans go in before and after. They're not waiting for the final result. They've sold the pub off, and it's going to be converted to flats, and that's a sad loss to the town.
You're on the brink now, right? I mean, this is what, days away, 5 games suspended. It's desperate, right?
Yeah, this is it. It's real. I was down here yesterday, and a delivery van pulled up on the far side of the forecourt, and one of the women went to see if they were coming to deliver something, and the bloke sat in, was a Bury fan, and he was in absolute tears, absolutely distraught. He said he'd just come for the final look. And this is it. It's affecting people. Like I said, I relate it to a bereavement in the family. It's affecting people. There's people with mental issues, and football's a massive release for them. And they're suffering, and it's horrendous. It is.
What about the players themselves? What are they doing right now? Well, you know, this is the point at which they should be well into the swing of their season.
Well, we've very few players left. You know, and the ones that are here have, you know, not been paid for months. And
he said he has provided proof of funding. The EFL has remained and refused to, you know, allow you to start the season.
All he's done is show them a letter saying he'd got a line of credit.
Right.
Which is, you know, it doesn't mean anything. That credit can be pulled at any time. And it's a difficult situation. And he's playing poker at the minute, because if the club goes out of the league tomorrow, there's no way they can fund the CVA, so it will automatically go into liquidation, and he gets nothing.
Joy Hart, former director, handcuffed herself to a drainpipe outside the club.
Yes.
Yesterday.
Well, it's you know, people are doing all sorts, and I mean, we've the six of us been working on trying to get buyers in. It's all day, every day, and it's hard work, and nobody wants to see the club go. I've just come down on the bus, and the young lad said, "Oh, you're the guy from Forever Bury." He came and shook me hand. He said, "I just thanks for all the work." He said, "I don't know if it's going to pay off, but thanks." And this is what we're getting all over town. There's a lot of goodwill, but people just feel absolutely frustrated, because the club is being punished, the town is being punished, the fans are being punished, and the one man that's caused all the problems is just going to walk away.
I think we echo those comments that people are saying to you on the bus, and sad that we can't offer more than saying good luck to you. But well done with your efforts, and good luck.
Yeah, right. Thanks a lot.
No worries there. Dave Gifford from Forever Bury. From Bury, we will go to Bolton. Ian Bridge is the co-founder of the Bolton Wanderers Supporters Trust. Ian, thanks for coming on.
That's great. Thanks for asking.
Not a problem. And we've just heard about the situation at Bury. It's a worrying time for them, and it's a worrying time for you as well. Phil Parkinson, the manager, resigned last night. Not a huge surprise?
Not really. I think Phil has been... there's all sorts of critics about his style of football, etc., etc., but I think there's one thing that I don't think any Bolton fan would dispute, and that's the fact that throughout 3 years of absolute disaster from an off-the-field point of view, he's behaved absolutely impeccably and with a great degree of dignity. And I'd like to personally thank him and his assistant, Steve Parkin, for the way they've conducted themselves throughout all this. But yeah, it wasn't a great surprise. I think his position really was untenable. He is a football creditor when all's said and done. And there's still bonuses outstanding from survival over 12 months ago. So I don't think there was any real doubt that this could happen. But I do think that the straw that broke the camel's back, as far as Phil and Steve are concerned, is this situation and having to play the kids.
Sure. And that's why they postponed the game, right? I don't know how much Phil Parkinson was involved in saying these kids have played too much. What, two 17-year-olds, three 18-year-olds playing in the last game?
Yeah, well, the recent home game against Coventry, the average, it's the youngest ever squad, average age was 19. You know, and to expect these lads, there's all sorts of arguments. We've got Sam Allardyce coming on saying that the kids, if they're good enough, they're old enough and all this business. Yeah, you can do that every now and then. And you always get a Wayne Rooney will come in at sort of just turn 17 and blow everybody away. But you're expecting a team of kids to play against a team of men, and it was obvious to all concerned. I didn't go to the Tranmere game, but I was there against Coventry, and it was obvious the challenges that were going in were men against boys. They played great, they were fantastic, and the enthusiasm and the work rate and the commitment was there. A lot of people fell back in love with Bolton Wanderers in that Coventry game, and they're just so appreciative of the way the lads were performing, and they were playing football as well. You know.
Ian, explain why you're in this situation. Why are you having to play kids? What's happened?
Why are we having to play kids? The club's in administration and has been so since the 13th of May. As I understood it, when an administrator comes in, he has to take over the running of the football club. He effectively is the holder of the golden chair that people talk about, which allows him to operate, or the club to operate. It was close season, and as you know, there's an awful lot goes on in close season. For whatever reason, this particular administrator, and he has got very, very highly paid consultants in there with him, this particular administrator has, for whatever reason, chosen to basically do nothing about administering the running of a football club. No season tickets have been put on sale. The club's not been able to look at putting any contracts in place with any players. There were a lot of players coming to the end of the contract anyway, so they went as a sort of natural wastage, if you want to call it that. There are players that gave the notice in because of the fact that they, and this is nothing to do with the administrator, but they hadn't been paid by a previous owner, who shall remain nameless. The playing side was decimated. We've had to cancel pre-season friendlies. They played a couple of games behind closed doors, but it was far, far from an ideal preparation pre-season wise. There are apparently players available to actually sign contracts and have been training with the squad, senior players that is. But there has been nothing able to be sanctioned by EFL because it's not been in a position to do so from a contractual point of view, for whatever reason. There were a couple of players actually signed before the first game of the season, the Wickham game, because we had special dispensation from EFL. There are too many parties in this who really have just sat back and sat on their hands.
The takeover by Football Ventures was apparently almost signed, sealed and delivered, only for Lawrence Bassini, the former Watford owner, who had previously tried to buy Bolton, getting a court order stopping the sale. Do you know why he did that and how he was able to do it?
Well, the legal side of it, he's obviously put an argument in front of the judge who's granted an injunction. So without seeing all that detail, I think the detail revolved around the fact that he is alleged to have had a signed sale and purchase agreement signed by himself and by Ken Anderson. And he has, on several occasions, tried to make out that he is actually the owner of Bolton Wanderers. And it sort of culminated in his performance in front of the stadium the other evening, which I wasn't there, but I believe it was quite comical if it wasn't so serious.
He was there with a loudspeaker standing outside the stadium, yeah. Right? It sounds bizarre.
Yeah, it does. It was bizarre. And I think there is a very, very good summary of what went on by one of our local blog sites, Lion of Vienna. If you Google Lion of Vienna Bassini, I think you'll probably find it. It tells the tale, unfortunately. But that doesn't get away from the fact that there was obviously an injunction granted. And the administrator put a statement out within hours, very quickly, and he did use the word disgust about the lodging of this injunction and saying that the deal was ready for signing and we were within hours of signing with Football Ventures. Now, that stopped things. The judgment was handed down at 3 p.m. last Wednesday, and we've still not got a deal signed. So I think that's a question you need to address to the administrator of Football Ventures, because I'm certainly at a loss to see why it hasn't been moved on since then. And as far as the injunction and the Bassini situation is concerned, that now appears to be, after the injunction decision and taking the reference to Burnden Ledger out of it, seems to be potentially a spat between Bassini and Ken Anderson. Crazy, a mess.
Yeah, it is a mess. Listen, Ian, look, we wish you the best of luck and we hope it all gets sorted out.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thanks for the time.
Total pleasure. Good luck to you, Ian Bridges. Let's bring in Ashley Brown, the Head of Governance for the Football Supporters Association. Ashley, how are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, yeah, very well, thanks. Look, we've just heard from fan representatives of Bury and Bolton, and it's clearly very troubling times for them. To sort of broaden it out a bit, what if anything is there to stop this situation happening at any club? Because, you know, I'm a Cambridge fan, we're well run at the moment, but we might not be forever.
Well, there isn't enough to stop it. I think that's the problem. And you look at both Bury and Bolton, these are problems that have built up over a number of years. It's not something that's just happened recently. And the governance in football is not strong enough to see when these issues are getting worse and worse and to be able to step in or stop them. And what we need to do is focus far more on prevention. At the moment, it's panic stations at Bolton and Bury, but it should have been stopped years ago.
And how do we do that?
We need stronger governance, and we need independent regulation. And when I mean independence, I talk about independence from owners. If we look at the Football League, it's effectively a members' club, and it, to be honest, struggles to govern itself in situations like these because many of the owners don't want to increase regulation against themselves. And, you know, some of that is for good reason if you're an owner. It's not all for nefarious reasons. But what we need to do is take that away in the way that most UEFA countries run themselves. And we need somebody such as the FA to step up and properly regulate club owners and football clubs. And if they won't do it, then perhaps we need to look elsewhere and look for support from government.
So that's, I'm just trying to work out whose responsibility it is. Is it the EFL? Is it the FA?
As it stands, the FA has effectively abdicated most of the responsibility of this sort of governance to the leagues, so to the Premier League and the Football League.
I keep hearing people saying that owners and clubs need to be regulated, but if someone buys a club legally, I don't see what can be done to stop them buying a club legally.
Well, what you can do is you can look at a number of things in the way that they buy the club to begin with. So how are they buying it? Where are they getting the money from? Is it real money? Is the money there? Once they're there, you need to look at ongoing stewardship, and you need to look at financing is important, ongoing finances. If you look at Bolton, for example, when Ken Anderson took over Bolton, he took it over with a £5 million loan from a rather interesting loan company at extortionate rates. You know, that's got bad signs written all over it. That could have been stopped. If you look at when he continued to run Bolton, he was able to sell off club assets that he shouldn't have been able to sell off. You look at Bury, and the owner previous to the current owner spent many years shifting money around his company and the football club in and out, various strange loan companies. Lots of these have got warning bells all over them, and those transactions shouldn't have been allowed to happen. And the Football League could have, if it wanted to, the power to stop that sort of financing.
So they genuinely have that power?
They would, to properly enforce it, they would need to make some changes to their own rules, but it's possible for them to do that.
Right, but it would require the owners of the clubs to support changing those rules.
To change the rules and then to properly regulate it. I mean, what we don't have, and you know, you could potentially argue that the Football League doesn't have the money and resources to properly regulate as well, but you need to keep an eye on what's happening. You can't just every 12 months look at a business plan and think everything's rosy. If someone in that 12-month period has slapped a great big charge against the football ground to risk its future or borrowed £6 million from a dodgy source at a ridiculous interest rate, you need to know about those transactions and say whether they're allowable or not.
Do you think that the one of the possible avenues would be putting in place an organisation comparable to what's called the DNCG in France, whereby, you know, the clubs have got to show every year how they're functioning financially and how viable they are, and they have to break even? Do you think that would be one possibility, perhaps?
Yeah, absolutely. That's the sort of thing that we're talking about. Now, the Football League would argue that they do that, but they don't do it in enough depth. And you don't have to. I mean, you know which clubs are going to be going through problems, and you know which ones are run well. So you can have a light touch on the ones that are run well, but you've got to go into the deep dive and do your real due diligence on the ones which are suspect. And if possible, there has to be a route to intervention. And that's the problem that we see ourselves, you know, in the next 24 hours or so with Bury in particularly, and who knows, perhaps Bolton next week or the week after. EFL don't currently really have the rules to intervene. They're going to be faced with a decision tomorrow where they're probably going to have to expel Bury because of the integrity of the competition. But what they really ought to be able to do is have walked into Bury, withdrawn the membership potentially, and given it to somebody else to run Bury at that position in the league, or just walked and run the club in an administrative sort of way instead of a financial administrator, a football administrator. We believe there are ways in which you could put those rules in place if there was interest to do it.
And you hear like really bland cliches like, look, there's so much money swilling about the game. Why can't we sort of, you know, spread it out so this never happens to any football team? Is there any sort of legitimate, does that mean anything, or is that just a pointless thing that pundits sort of draw out occasionally?
No, I think, personally, I'm of the view that solidarity across the leagues could be more generous than it currently is. The bulk of the money is always going to be at the top. It would be nice to see more distributed, but it's because that money is at the top that causes all the problems. If you look at the Championship, which is the craziest league in the world, why is there so much debt in the Championship? It's because everyone's chasing that £170 million guaranteed a season if you pop up into the Premier League. And so that's the start of all the problems. We're never going to get to a position where it's equally handed out across the leagues. Improved solidarity would definitely help. But also, we have to look at what we do with the Championship and the fact that too many owners are chasing the dream, or the millions really, to get in the league, and are quite happy to risk not only their own fortunes on occasions, but also the future of their clubs. And that's trickling down. You know, you're seeing silly wages being paid in League One and League Two. They thought they got them under control with changes to the rules, but in the most recent reports, they're up again. League One is at 94% of revenue, but the Championship, 106% of revenue. How can you survive when you're spending more on your player wages than you can possibly bring in the season?
Ashley, thanks so much for your time and explaining all of that for us.
No problem, thank you.
Ashley Brown there, the head of governance for the Football Supporters Association, and that'll do for part two. We'll start part three with a preview of Serie A. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra, a Serie A preview. Barry.
Hello.
Do you want to hear one?
AC Milan are my tip.
Marco
and Sassuolo.
Yeah. Oh, good idea. Nikki.
Yes.
What have been the biggest changes this summer? I'm fascinated to see how Aaron Ramsey does. That's my hot take.
There's been a little bit. There's been a little bit of movement, hasn't there? I mean, Juventus sort of, I guess, even before the summer, I was going to say they came out tearing out the blocks this summer. They came tearing out the blocks before the summer with Ramsey. They added Adrian Rabiot at the start of July on a free transfer. They then went and signed Matthias de Ligt, which for me is one of the biggest transfers we've seen in Italy in decades, maybe. Because, I mean, you can talk about Ronaldo, but Ronaldo, while it's clearly an epochal signing for Juventus, you're talking about someone who is very much at the end of his career looking for, I don't know, a last opportunity to build his legacy. I can't think of the last time an Italian club won like a genuine competition for one of the hottest young players in Europe. I mean, De Ligt was, it's hard to know exactly how much each club was willing to go to, but he was at least on the radars of Barcelona, yeah. Real Madrid, PSG, mm-hmm. Bayern Munich, and Juventus got him. So they started incredibly this summer, and by any objective basis you look at their squad and it's stronger than it was last season. You know, they've added a few other less obvious names, but Demiral from Sassuolo is a good player as well, Danilo as well, for depth and defense, but they've now wound up in this weird situation where they did all of that business early and there was this assumption that, well, now they'll get rid of the players they need to get rid of, and they haven't. Gonzalo Higuain is still there. Paulo Dybala is still there. You know, a lot of people would like him to be there, but at least in theory, he was supposed to be moving out in this sort of huge overhaul they've had. Mario Mandzukic still there. Sami Khedira in midfield. I mean, how you're getting all these players in midfield particularly is just mind-boggling. It was already a question with Ramsey, adding Rabiot as well. Sami Khedira in the last week saying, oh no, I'm planning to be back and playing this season. You've got Maurizio Sarri, the manager, saying look, we've got more players than we can actually put on our Champions League list. This is with a manager who famously does not rotate his team. So Juventus have got all the tools, at least in theory, to run away with it all again. But it feels like a mess. It feels like a team that has, since Beppe Marotta left, you know, and he left right after that Ronaldo deal, which clearly he was not a big part of, and Fabio Paratici has sort of taken the reins of the ins and outs of the club, it really feels like the grown-ups have left the room, and this has sort of got a bit chaotic. So that's all happened. Sarri, on top of all of this, has come down with pneumonia and is probably not going to be on the bench for the first game of the season against Parma. The second game of the season is against Napoli, so it's a big start. Meanwhile, big changes. Antonio Conte is the most obvious one, which is actually answering your question, at Inter. And it's taken him all summer to get what he wanted, which is Lukaku. I mean, that was day one obvious that he wanted him. There's talk, of course, that Sanchez could soon be there as well. So just recreating the United attack that didn't work. but they've made some really good additions as well. I mean, Barella in midfield is one of those players who just has burst to prominence in the last year in Italy as someone who the Italian national team are absolutely going to be sort of, I think, built around going forwards, and I think a real upgrade for the midfield. But there's other players as well. Diego Godin coming in to strengthen that back three. And Conte, of course, just himself has this reputation that is earned of being a manager who wins things. I mean, he did it at Juventus. He started this cycle and he's come to Chelsea at a time when I think a lot of people didn't think he'd be able to win the league with them, and won straight away. So there's a lot of expectation and hope around Inter at a time when Juventus just looked like, again, on paper, Juventus are still streets ahead of everyone, but just looked like there could be reasons to be vulnerable. Personally, I think that while everyone's talking about those two, nobody's paid enough attention to the fact that Napoli, who were already the second best team in Italy, signed Kostas Manolas from Roma, who, in my opinion, was one of the best defenders in Serie A last season, put him alongside the best defender in Serie A last season, Kalidou Koulibaly, and you've got a partnership that should be exceptional. They've just signed Irving Lozano as well to give them a bit more creativity up front. It seems like they still have a bit more money to add options in attack, because they have been trying, without success so far, to get Mauro Icardi from Inter. I think Napoli have a real, real shot at this if Juventus slip. So I think the title race, at least, is, on paper, in theory, as interesting as it has looked to me in years. Of course, come back to me in a month's time when Juventus is 12 points clear already. but I think that's super compelling in Serie A this season. And lots of upheaval at Roma and Milan behind them as well.
Anything else to look out for? A Ribery to Fiorentina's fun, yes. And Balotelli to Brescia as well.
Yeah, Fiorentina have been bought out by American Ownership Group, and sort of from last year being the team of youth and Italian prospect in Serie A, have now become the team of, I don't know, fascinating veteran players who we know are good, but also, are they really what they need? Which is, you know, Kevin Prince-Boateng is there, Frank Ribery is there. I'm fascinated to watch Ribery there, but whether or not he will excel, I'll say the jury's out until we've seen it. Balotelli going to Brescia is a romantically lovely story, because that's where he grew up, that's where he's from, perhaps at this point in his career, which has been such a nomadic career at a certain point, where he's not fulfilled his potential that we thought he had at the beginning of his career, it seems like a nice thing to come back there and to try and do something in a Brescia team that was really exciting and attacking in Serie B last season. They've already got this striker Donnarumma, no relation to the Milan goalkeeper Donnarumma, who was scoring hatfuls of goals last season. They've got Sandro Tonali in midfield, who is this Andrea Pirlo lookalike, and therefore has been branded as the next Pirlo, who isn't quite the same, but is a, you know, really good distributor. That'll be a fun team to watch as well, yeah.
A few Juve-based questions. They'd call for Serie A to schedule more early kickoffs to help grow the club in Asia. I just wonder how Serie A view moving kickoffs around, all those things, compared to, say, here or Germany, where you think in Germany the fans sort of seem to have more power, or dead against it, and we sort of lie down and just, you know, take what's given.
They've already done this a bit in the last few years in Italy, and, you know, Italy in general can be culturally resistant to change, and certainly within football there has been some. But it's sort of the protests have not been so significant as to disrupt anything. I mean, I think about a few years ago when they introduced the lunchtime kickoff, on a Sunday, and Parma fans had what they called La Protesta del Panino, which is the sandwich protest, which was at kickoff, everyone pulls out a sandwich and starts to eat it, which, you know, it's not a protest that
sounds really
necessarily
nice.
it's going to disrupt the authorities from doing what they're doing. So yes, there'll be some grumbling, but it won't affect anything. I think there was, there was more grumbling about actually with the same thing, moving the games earlier on Sunday, was more grumbling from prominent church figures saying, oh, you're eating into the time when family should be at mass. But again, football doesn't listen anymore. Football follows its financial motives.
Stephen says, any chance of Dybala to Spurs being resurrected in January? Is that over?
I would say there's a very real chance, depending on what happens in the next bit. I mean, again, Juventus have too many players, and especially up front, it's really a mess. He's not the player that a lot of people would like to see leave. He's just the only player who really looks like someone you can monetize. And, I mean, it's very hard from the outside right now to understand Juventus' financial thinking. Ronaldo last season was unquestionably like a big gamble. You looked at it and thought, they can't really afford this, but maybe he'll bring in enough interest and revenue and sponsorship deals that it's worth it. Now, the wages they're paying Ramsey, the wages they're paying Rabiot, the deal for De Ligt, they've increased it hugely again without showing us yet where they're getting it from. And so Dybala really is the one monetizable player you've got there. Obviously, they cashed in on Moise Kean, which...
Was that a surprise?
No, because he was in the last year of his contract, because there was no real choice. I think there was some frustration about it. I think he's a player who has huge potential, and you don't want to be letting go of at a price that is much less than you think he would be worth if he had more than 1 year on his contract. Mm. But again, they have to do something to offset what they've done. And the thing with Kean is, while it isn't the value that you think he's worth, it is all gain. They haven't had to spend anything to get him in the first place. So on your books, in your finances, it looks great. This is a player who we spent nothing on, and we're selling him for, I can't remember what the figure was now, 30 million.
Any chance that we might see Paulo Dybala stepping in at PSG, for example? Because there was some talk about that.
Again, you know, it's entirely possible to me right now. And we had this really weird situation all summer in Italy, with almost like what felt like a set of dominoes up front. Mm. There was Edin Dzeko, who wanted to leave Roma. There was Mauro Icardi, who had been told loudly and repeatedly by Inter that he was not wanted there, even though he has sort of persistently said, oh no, I'm quite happy at Inter. I think I want to stay here and play for my place. You know, Conte has said it, the directors have said it. He's not part of their plans. But things have got weird now, because first of all, the Premier League window has closed, and the Premier League was a place that everyone was looking to as, these are clubs that have the money to buy these players. Now Edin Dzeko, after himself making, you know, noises that he wanted to leave all summer, has signed a new contract at Roma. And so you're left with Inter and Juventus, both in awkward situations with high-value assets that they don't know what to do with. Dybala and Icardi are both really sort of like sticking out as awkward situations right now. Now, the one thing with Dybala is, if he does stay, I think he'll play. Icardi is a different situation, because the club has so deliberately stated, you are not part of our plan. They'll have to bring him in and let him train with the first team. There's already stuff going on with that, because Icardi's, a lawyer representing Icardi, basically sent a letter to the club this summer saying, look, if he doesn't get sold, he's going to be part of first team training, isn't he? And there's been no official response to that, but it's important, because if he's not, there'll be a constructive dismissal case, which will be a disaster, because then you get nothing for him. So there are two really, really awkward situations, especially the one at Inter, which I think, frankly, is in significant part of their own making, that are yet to be resolved as we, you know, are currently 2 days away from the start of the season.
And the one thing, do they have a computer at Juve where they follow every single player who's in the last year of their contract? and who will be their targets next year? Who is in the pipeline for Juve?
Philippe, I want to go to France now.
Oh, plenty.
And you are a French man.
Yes.
Takeover of Nice by British billionaire Jim Ratcliffe. Okay. Wondered which side of the fence you'd be on with that. Why are you not happy about that?
I'm not too happy about Ratcliffe, full stop, anyway. But I don't know. It's very odd. I mean, it's something which has been on the cards for quite a while. The deal was supposed to have been concluded. Actually, they went public with local papers, Nice Matin, actually, last season already. the amount of money that he's investing into it is insignificant compared to his means. And you do wonder what kind of project it is, or if it's just a way to park some money as part of his building this huge sports football portfolio, because he obviously is involved in cycling, amongst other things.
Yeah, I was going to ask, he's the guy that bought Sky and turned it into Ineos.
Yeah, Team Ineos, yes, absolutely. And he's a Monaco resident, Brexit-supporting Monaco resident. It's not very clear, actually, even to the locals. They, to be honest, they said it was a great thing that he was coming in, because what they looked at is, oh, we've got an owner who is very rich. So you try to explain to them, well, it's not because you've got a very rich owner that he's going to put a lot of money into the club. The club is doing okay. If you look at the league table at the moment, it looks pretty stable. It's not very exciting to watch, actually, the very opposite of it. But what you wonder is the potential for growth, unless you actually put an awful, awful lot of money in it. And that doesn't seem to be the case.
Tell us about Rennes starlet Eduardo Camavinga.
Where do we start? I think that after about 5 seconds of seeing him on the ball, I mean, he played a few games before and bits of games as well, as early as last season. He's only 16 years of age. He is Franco-Congolese, Angolese, and apparently, well, not apparently, has chosen France, as is much to the chagrin of some others, to be the country that he wants to play for and will play for if his career is looked after, you know, properly, as it should. I must say, it's very rare. Normally, I wouldn't go for this kind of hype. I haven't been excited about a player of that age for a very, very long time. He's got absolutely everything.
Apparently Arsenal and Spurs already tried to get him before the deadline.
Yeah.
He could get a game with Bolton.
I'm not surprised at all. He was at Fougères before, so it's a small local club, and Rennes saw him and said, well, no, here you come. And he's now a fulcrum of that team. He's not going to be used by Stéphane, you know, week in, week out. Physically, even though he finished the game against PSG in fantastic shape, he'll have to be looked after. If you haven't seen him play, I would say that in terms of the type of player he is, he's got the distribution, and I'm not hyping, of an Andrea Pirlo. He's got the kind of the legginess as well, the way he controls the ball really makes me think of Jean Tigana a lot. So we're not talking about small-time players.
No pressure, Eduardo.
No pressure. No, he's phenomenally exciting, technically extremely gifted. And I think what's even more important is that his perception of space is absolutely exceptional. That's one thing you can do. You could look the whole of this PSG game, which he bossed from start to finish, and look at the way he's always positioning himself to receive the ball. He's got the technique to be able to get out of very tight spaces. His long passing is terrific. We've all seen the assist for the Rennes goal, for the winning goal. But there was a pass after that, which was one of those laser-beamed, transversal, as we call them, which was just breathtaking. He is... I should stop here, because it's really so dangerous and risky to build up a player of that kind. But he's an extraordinary talent. Extraordinary.
He shares a birthday with Wilfried Zaha, but was born a decade later.
Yeah.
That's how old we are, Barry. Tom Williams tweeting, as per today's L'Equipe, PSG have already rejected the following bids for Neymar: €40 million and Coutinho and Rakitic from Barcelona, or a loan with compulsory option to buy of between €160 million and €180 million from Barcelona, or €100 million plus Bale, James and Navas from Real Madrid. What's happening?
Well, the circus, is still in town, basically. It's just a ludicrous situation. He's supposedly fit to play. Supposedly. He's come back from his holiday. He didn't have a 3 month holiday like last year in Brazil. The situation with the fans is absolutely appalling. There are banners at every PSG game saying, basically, move on, in not as polite terms as that. The relationship is completely broken. But this being said, there are so many... And it's completely... The atmosphere at the club is, again, absolutely rotten. But you wonder at PSG, when things are going to stabilise. People thought the arrival of Leonardo would change everything. Suddenly, we've got somebody who is going to be in charge, is going to impose some discipline in the group, somebody who has a clear idea of how to build a team, and will work with Tuchel. And what we have seen so far, I mean, look at that game against Rennes again. They were appalling. They were so bad. Absolutely appalling. And I think they had three shots on target the whole game against Rennes. A Rennes team, you know, which, okay, did very well in the league, has got a very good young manager, some nice young players and so forth. But it's a shambles. And unfortunately, Neymar is at the very center of that because he attracts all of the attention. He attracts all of the controversy. And PSG, in a way, is going to be defined by what it does with Neymar.
Haven't they? They've removed all merchandise with his name and from the club shop, and all the Neymar branding is gone, which suggests, you know, that's it. He is finished at this club.
Well, this is the way it's looking. And, you know, even what Leonardo has said on the record about Neymar, saying, you know, we've been received offers. Basically, we're willing to let him go. But who's going to get him?
Mm. Obviously, those are the deals that PSG have rejected in the past few weeks. Harder for them to use Coutinho as a make weight now. He's at Bayern Munich, but you never know. Or he could go to, like, what about money plus, say, Rakitic and Bale, and then he just plays one game for Barcelona and one game for Real Madrid? Could work, couldn't it?
The 100 million quid plus Bale plus Navas plus
Hamas
seems
decent.
Decent, yeah. I'd have thought that's... I'd snap their hand off with that. Because, quite frankly, I've just think he's more trouble than he's worth, and wherever he ends up,
also,
will end badly as well.
The thing is that when he's on the pitch, he's actually delivered for PSG. I think people have been very tough on him for, you know, what he did when he had the PSG shirt on. Very often, he was the only player to genuinely fight, which might surprise a few to hear that. But the problem is that, of course, he hasn't played a full season for quite a long time.
And also, as producer Jonathan rightly points out, that wages, if you take Bale, Hammers and Navas, that is the best part of €1 million a week that you add to your wage bill.
They can afford it.
Well, that is true. In other wages news, a good week for Jadon Sancho. He's agreed a new contract with Borussia Dortmund, about 190 grand a week, including his bonuses. So well done to Jadon. So some breaking news now from producer Jonathan. This is very much like the Vidi printer. He's typing it out one letter at a time. We've got an L. Lee Catamol has signed for VVV Venlo of the Eredivisie. I mean, I've got to say, as anticlimaxes go...
That is the most underwhelming breaking news I've ever heard.
I was so excited. And it's sort of pathetic. Says more about me. I thought it would have something to do with the pod or something that it would genuinely affect our lives and my life. But anyway, good luck to Lee Catamol. And we will follow VVV Venlo with much more diligence than we certainly have ever before. In other news, Wales skipper Ashley Williams has been left out of their squads for the Euro 2020 qualifier against Azerbaijan in Cardiff next month. Gareth Bale will take over. Williams doesn't have a club at the moment, so it sort of seems fair enough. He's set to join Bristol City. Although I like the idea of Gareth Bale not playing for anyone but Wales, and maybe he could start, you know, Ashley Williams. They could all just quit club football and just play for Wales. Wayne Rooney got a straight red. Did anyone see this?
I did, yes.
For a forearm smash.
The referee did, or rather VAR did.
VAR spotted. It was at a corner, yeah. It was sort of off the ball. I think it probably was. He left his arm in there, didn't he?
Well, there was a similar sort of challenge in the recent All-Ireland hurling final where Kilkenny had a man sent off for... Similar challenge.
I thought that's what you're meant to do in hurling.
No.
You're meant to hit people with sticks.
And opinion was divided. I would have thought, personally, I think Rooney's was a red and the one in the All-Ireland final was a dark yellow-orange.
Okay. That was DC United's game against the New York Red Bulls. They lost 2-1.
Second red card of the season for Weser.
I know. Mm. The proposed stadium site for David Beckham's Inter Miami franchise... has arsenic contamination levels more than twice the legal limit. This is according to an environmental report. Mel Rees Golf Course has been closed by Miami City Council. Plans are in place to build a stadium, a shopping mall, a hotel and a public park at the site. It's going to cost $1 billion. The Miami Mayor, Francis Suarez, says this obviously causes great concerns. So, I mean, I think double the amount of arsenic is... I think concern is the right thing to have, isn't it? Let's look at the Premier League games then this weekend. Big game is Liverpool-Arsenal, the 5:30 game on Saturday. I'm fascinated to see how this one goes Philippe, because Liverpool have been, you know, this high line they're defending with, and Arsenal playing quite nice stuff at the moment.
Yeah, playing also interesting stuff defensively. It was quite a hairy at times against Burnley. It's one I would go for definitely more than four goals in that game, if I may say so. It could be a terrific one to watch for the neutral, but the way that this Arsenal, when you see the problems that Liverpool have had defensively, I mean, in this at this very early stage of the season and without serious consequences on the results, and you do wonder what unleashing Nicolas Pepe, who looked absolutely magnificent in the second half against Burnley, plus Aubameyang, plus Lacazette, plus Ceballos, you wonder what kind of effect it could have on them.
Well, Pepe, especially because Andy Robertson would presumably be the guy lined up opposite him. We know that Robertson likes to get forward. I think it would be a bold move, but yes, it would be fascinating to see him do it.
They haven't won at Anfield since 2012, but you think they'll go for it?
I don't know. I don't feel like Unai Emery has particularly gone for the boldest approaches away from home, but perhaps given that away from home didn't work out so well last season, this would be a moment to do it.
Daniel Sturridge has joined the Turkish side Trabzonspor on a three-year deal. He was released by Liverpool in the summer. 6 years there, he scored 67 in 160 appearances, which actually is not a bad return. It's just not enough games, is it, in 6 years?
No. I've never been particularly convinced by him as a striker. And for no particular reason, I put my finger... I have a feeling Tammy Abraham is going to be the same. I'm just not convinced by Tammy Abraham as a Premier League striker. But, you know, prove me wrong.
The thing about Sturridge is that he's got probably twice the talent that Divock Origi has got. And if you look at the moments that he has provided for Liverpool, all I can think of is that strike against Chelsea, which gave him a draw last season. A very important strike, very beautiful goal, but really underwhelming. Mm. So is it a problem of his physique? I mean, he's quite fragile, has had a lot of problems with that. It's a question of attitude, I couldn't say. But you know, it's a bit of a waste for you because he's such a wonderful talent, beautiful finisher.
In the Soccer AM glory years, I trained with Bolton. I've probably mentioned it. And Sturridge was there.
Oof.
And he was, I mean, unbelievable. Like, literally every single thing went in. I mean, it was, I don't think I'd ever seen being that close to a footballer of that ability. Mm. That it, you know, they just sort of talk about natural finishes and Robbie Fowler being a natural finisher, that kind of thing. And obviously that was Bolton, and that was a training session, and I was there, right? So it is not playing for Liverpool now, but yeah, incredible natural ability.
I remember this goal for Man City, I think his first year at Man City as well, where suddenly one of those moments you think, wow, a star is born.
Mm. Well, he hasn't retired. I mean, like, he could
but going to the Super League is quite close to retirement, isn't it?
Well, we don't want to upset the Trabzonspor fans listening to us. The Friday night game is Villa-Everton. The early kickoff on Saturday, Norwich v Chelsea. Norwich haven't beaten Chelsea since 1994. But I think I think Norwich could win this one, Nicky.
Yeah, well, I mean, again, I suppose a bit like with Liverpool, but much more so. Chelsea are playing under Lampard this wide open style. They're leaving these sort of huge gaps between midfield and defence. It feels like a game for Buendia and Cantwell in particular, sort of the gaps they're going to have there if Chelsea play the way they have the last two games. As I often do when I'm looking ahead at some of these games, you check into the website whoscored.com just to have a look at some of the numbers. And I notice they have these sort of like notes on the team saying like things they're good at and not. And I just enjoyed that a weakness for Norwich was listed as defending against skillful players.
Yeah, well, that is a problem.
Like, I mean, that's...
If you put them against a bunch of lumps, they're really good.
Like, it's such a particular way of phrasing it. And Chelsea do have some skillful players, so maybe they're in trouble.
That's true. Baz, do you want to know the goal scorers from the Norwich victory over Chelsea in 1994?
Jeremy Goss, Mark Robbins, and Ian Roberts.
Two goals for Ashley Ward, and one for a player who is still playing.
Go away.
Wow. Jamie Cureton.
He's still playing.
He's interim player manager for Bishop Stortford now in the Isthmian League Premier Division. And he was playing in that Hong Kong Sevens tournament I went to, and he was unbelievable. Just... Yeah, I mean, I suppose quite a lot of them were ex-pros who'd been out on the source the night before, but...
Who's the best player you've shared a pitch with?
Yap Stam.
Okay.
Who, it's arguably marked me out of the game, I'm going to say. David says, having watched Chelsea this season, I've noticed that's similarly to last season when I was constantly told Jorginho was playing in Kante's position, resulting in him being played out of position, which they're still doing. Can you tell me what N'Golo Kante's correct position is? He's got a point that Sarri got all sorts of abuse for playing Jorginho there, and Lampard is playing Jorginho there.
Quite clear the position in which he established himself as the best in this position in the world. I think it's not exactly complicated, which is the position you had at Leicester, which is the position you had at Chelsea for a while, the position you had with the French national team. So actually, that's one thing you would expect perhaps from the game at Norwich, for him to drop in a sort of a more... A position where he's closer to his back four and he's given a bit of help to Jorginho, perhaps?
Will Jorginho be dropped? Because Chelsea's midfield has been overrun in both their league games so far, and there's a very good chance that Norwich will do the exact same thing. So you surely got to change something, and the obvious change, I can see, is get rid of Jorginho. And
we shall see. Brighton, Southampton, Manchester United, Palace, Sheffield United, Leicester City. Watford play West Ham also on Saturday. On Sunday, it's Bournemouth City at 2:30, Spurs, Newcastle. Oystein says, will Barry disclose the winner of the vacant Barry Spurs seat?
Well, you didn't want it.
Nope.
So I said I'd
it's a giveaway on Twitter.
Give it away on Twitter. Yeah. And you told me that was a terrible idea, and you were right.
So have you not? You offered it, and now you're withdrawing
the
offer.
Yes, I've rescinded my offer because people are twats.
Well, you don't know. Not everyone.
You try and do something. People don't deserve nice things.
Why not? How? What would you base this on?
Huh?
Why? What would you base it? You got some nice responses.
Yeah.
Are you going to take someone to the game or not?
We shall see.
Okay. Wolves play Burnley as well. T says, I always thought that Michael Owen Dubai advert campaign was the gold standard of football advertisement. It is tremendous. However, have any of the pods seen the new Ronaldo advert for Shopee? It's my favourite thing ever. It is tremendous, isn't it, Nikki?
It's something else, yeah.
You sort of wonder... maybe no one has enough money, but I imagine Cristiano Ronaldo has enough money to not have to do the... It's the baby shark.
Yeah.
Dance, isn't it?
It's the Baby Shark tune. Definitely.
Tune, sorry, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Which means that when you watch it, even as you've sort of laughed and mocked the ridiculousness of it, afterwards you'll come away with it in your head because that's what that tune does.
Yeah. And Cal says, every time an episode finishes on Spotify, it auto-plays the episode after England got knocked out of the World Cup. Can we please get that episode deleted? The Croatians never got tired, and I have to relive that pain twice a week. Oh, that is desperate. That is. Do you set up the Spotify? I mean, that is trolling of the highest order, isn't it? Anyway, we'll do what we can, Cal. Thanks so much, Baz. Thanks for coming on.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Nikki.
Thanks.
Thanks, Philippe.
Thank you.
We'll be back on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.